are not necessarily those of IR and its advertisers.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And of course, this evening our guest is Don Scott, and Don is a retired teacher from Canada who, instead of just fading away in retirement, took on the job of beginning to research the chronic fatigue syndrome, and it covered fascinating things as far as chronic fatigue, the fact that the government had engineered these chronic diseases and grown all sorts of mosquitoes in an effort to see how effectively many of these chronic mycoplasma infections could be disseminated by mosquitoes throughout the Western world, how they had actually worked to disseminate this chronic fatigue syndrome, which is a real disease related to mycoplasma and sometimes to brucellosis and other disease processes. And of course, he just hasn't given up. He keeps right on working. He's written a number of books, some of which we do carry here. But we always enjoy having Don on. And of course, he's written a new book on the background of the AIDS epidemic. Where did AIDS really come from? Well, of course, they would like us to believe that it just occurred out of nowhere. It's always been here. Or maybe somebody had eaten an infected monkey. Or, ladies and gentlemen, this is an engineered disease. And there's no question. Why do I say that? Well, very, very simply because, first of all, of a book written by Len Horowitz, which goes into the fact that the government was planning on creating a new disease for which there'd be no treatment at all. It goes back to 1969 to the testimony of a Dr. Donald MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee. And we have the entire text of what Dr. MacArthur said at that time. And he asked for $10 million in 1969 to create a new disease for which there'd be no treatment. And that Chris mentioned that some people thought it shouldn't be developed because it was a new method of mass killing. We actually have the complete text of that testimony. It is available through Radio Liberty, all nicely bound for you. And then, of course, we have the National Security Study Memorandum 200, released in 1974, over the name of Henry Kissinger. This says the major thrust of American policy is worldwide population control. And then the writings of people like Jacques Cousteau and Bertrand Russell, who write about the importance of killing off large segments of the world's population. And then, of course, a book by Gary Glum called Final Disclosure, where he actually records what a man who's dying of cancer tells him about his involvement with creating this new disease. And then, of course, Don has uncovered a number of government documents that were supposed to have been shredded, but they were not, the Special Virus Cancer Project. But I'm going to let Don tell you this whole incredible story of how certain dark sides of our government have created terrible diseases that are plaguing people throughout the world today. Don Scott, thank you so very much for being with us. Don, are you there? Don Scott, are you there? Well, I don't know what happened to Don Scott.
On the line.
Okay, very good. Well, you go right ahead. So
yes.
We want you, of course, to tell us about, you know, what you've come up with about your new book and anything else you'd like to tell our listeners tonight.
Well, thank you. That is a pretty open field there, but as you say, we set out, my son William and I, we set out to discover as much as we could about this awful disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, and we were...
Hold that thought, we'll be back in just a moment. All right, Don, go right ahead.
Okay, we're all clear now,
yep,
are we, Dr. Sam?
Right ahead.
Well, as I say, my son and I began studying chronic fatigue syndrome at the request of a lady who needed help, and we very, very rapidly learned very solid information that chronic fatigue syndrome was related in some mysterious way to another epidemic that had turned up in 1981 officially, and that of course was the AIDS epidemic. The chronic fatigue was a mirror image of AIDS, where AIDS, the victim, his T-cell count went down. In the chronic fatigue, it went up, but there were damage in both cases to the immune system, so that individuals seemed to be dreadfully ill, but seemed to have no way of being treated that would restore their natural immunity. And so we turned our attention to AIDS and discovered a lot of things along the way. We learned, for example, that the AIDS as a disease created in a laboratory in the United States of America actually got pretty solidly underway in the 1952 to 1959 period when President Eisenhower was president. It wasn't that Eisenhower supported the development of the AIDS pathogens, but he was rather lax in overseeing what some of his people were doing. And he had appointed Nelson Rockefeller as a Assistant Secretary of State for Health, Education, and Welfare. And he said to Nelson, okay, there you go, get into HEW along with the old, whatever her name was, I forget, and assist in the HUE. And Rockefeller did something rather strange as a assistant director of, or as a secretary of state for HUE. He brought a number of people from what we call the Rockefeller apparat. Now that is
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment here with Don Scott. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don was just saying that under the Eisenhower administration, 1952, 1960, somewhere in there, that there were the major tenets were started, the major thrust was started to create this new disease, which became AIDS, and of course that Nelson Rockefeller was involved very deeply. He then working with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, brought a number of people he referred to as the Rockefeller, what do you call them, the Rockefeller establishment, or what?
I call it the Rockefeller apparat.
All right.
Because it extended so vastly throughout not just the United States but the world through the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller Institute and the Institute of Medicine and the Rockefeller University and the vast holdings that they had in Standard Oil and all other major companies in the United States. And part of the Rockefeller apparat was given over to studying problems that would impact adversely upon the Rockefeller kingdom almost, and that of course meant looking at where do raw supplies come from that the United States industrial machine requires, and what happens if you get a whole lot more people wanting to share in those goods than are presently sharing in them. And they came to the conclusion that there were indeed far too many people in the world, and that it was going to go to the point where it would be unsustainable, and that they would therefore have to get rid of a good percentage of those people, reduce the population of the United States down to about 150 million, and reduce the population of the world by a billion or so. And they had quite an apparatus of scientists led by Dr. Oswald Avery and others, and working hand in glove with many very reputable institutions such as the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and so on. They were working at ways and means of developing disease pathogens that would limit population growth. And they didn't initially have the support of government, of course, until Eisenhower was elected, and he puttered away out on the White House lawn playing golf, while Nelson Rockefeller went into HUE, Health, Education, and Welfare, and he brought a lot of people from the Rockefeller apparatus in with him. And he established what he called a war room. Now, we think, of course, that the language says an awful lot about what was going on, the war room in health, education, and welfare. And he brought these people in from the Rockefeller apparatus and was there with them for about 18 months, 2 years or so. And during that time, they integrated the National Institutes of Health and the Center for Disease Control in with the military's research into biological weapons and so on. And they had the Army actually financing research in all manner of esoteric subjects, which had one thing in common, a number of them did, and that was, how did it impact on the human immune system? And after Rockefeller had been as Assistant Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare for a couple of years, and he had the NIH and the CDC tied in with the Pentagon, he asked Eisenhower for a new job. And Eisenhower obliged, and the new job was to be the man between Eisenhower and the CIA, which was led by Alan Dulles, a great colleague and friend and protege almost of Rockefeller's. And Eisenhower was happy to appoint him because Eisenhower had a strange trait. He did not like to lie, and yet he would go along with dishonest things. For example, Patrice Lumumba, in the newly emerging Congo, Free Congo at the time, emerging from Belgian colonial domination, they wanted him out of the way. And somehow or other, the CIA got the idea that Eisenhower wanted Lumumba dead. And in two or three sources we've tracked down, Eisenhower never says that in ordinary language right out loud, but as one person who was at one of the meetings says, Eisenhower gave the orders with a wink and a nod. Never really said it out loud, so he had plausible deniability. He could say, oh no, I never at any time ordered the murder of Patrice Lumumba. Well, anyway, Lumumba was ordered murdered, and there's quite a story about all of that. And he was finally dispatched with the help of the CIA and the help of Sidney Gottlieb, who was a member of the CIA technical staff working on biological weapons development. Eisenhower wanted somebody to stand between him and the CIA so that they could make decisions about CIA activities and tell Eisenhower with a wink and a nod, as it were, what was going on, but giving Eisenhower the opportunity when asked about any of these things, no, our government will not be engaged with any of that. And of course he got caught out in a limb when the U-2 was shot down over Russia. He thought the plane was totally destroyed and that he could lie about where the plane was and so on. And he was found out in a lie there. But Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's job in the CIA was to work with Allen Dulles to develop something that had come along that was very welcome to the Rockefeller eugenicists and population control people. And what had come along was this. Dr. Robert Huebner, who had been retained by the United States Navy to study the problem of why do naval recruits every spring get a type of walking pneumonia, whereas ordinary citizens of the United States, the same age and the same health status and so on, don't seem to get it nearly as much. And Huebner went to work studying pneumonia in Navy recruits. And that was the beginning of AIDS in laboratory development terms.
And that was, of course, because they got a mycoplasma infection? Was that a mycoplasma pneumonia?
Yes, indeed. Huebner discovered that when he got sputum and throat swabs and all the other sort of samples that they could get from these sick recruits, he discovered that there was an organism in there that they could now see with their more high-powered microscopes that they'd previously been missing, and he started off calling it a pleural pneumonia organism, a PPO.
We used to call it atypical pneumonia, but we had no idea what was causing it.
Yes, Huebner had no idea either until he got onto this naval task force studying pneumonia. And then he discovered something else. Now, this is the main part, linkage with AIDS, and it's also a link with something else, which is for Alzheimer's. Huebner realized that a significant number of the recruits who had pleural pneumonia back in the late 40s, also a number of them developed very bad adenoids. They're adenoids at the top of the nasal chamber in their head spontaneously degenerated, he said. Now, those are his words from one article he wrote. Now, we know nothing degenerates spontaneously. Something is degenerating it. And he excised all manner of infected adenoids from these recruits, and he was studying those under a microscope, and he discovered the same organism that he saw in their tonsils or in their throat, the pleural pneumonia organism. He saw the same thing in the degenerating adenoids, and he called it a pleural pneumonia-like organism, PPLO. And a few years later, some other doctors who knew the mycoplasma better than that corrected him and said, look, that's not a PPLO, that is a mycoplasma. And the mycoplasma, they realized from Huebner's studies, could somehow or other cause certain tissues in the body to degenerate. And that is one of the features of AIDS, as we will be able to develop along the way here. But the mycoplasma causing the degeneration of healthy tissues immediately became of great interest to the population control people.
Hold that thought, Don. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Don Scott. Well, Don has been talking about the discovery of mycoplasma. Now, when I graduated from medical school in 1952, I'd never heard of mycoplasma.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets. A little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Right. wrong with some genocidal policies. There are too many people in the world. Lots of them are in third world nations. A lot of them are black. They see nothing wrong with eliminating a lot of blacks, but of course they're not going to come out and say that. So you pick up the story there.
All right. Well, Rockefeller and Alan Dulles in the early 1950s, about 1953, established a program that they called MK Ultra, and it had two subdivisions, MK Naomi and MK Delta. And our research now demonstrates conclusively that the MK stands for monkey kidneys. We've got several articles that refer to the development of the mycoplasma being grown on monkey kidneys. So at first they got a whole bunch of monkey kidneys from the Yerkes monkey farm in Atlanta, Georgia, and then they established the Delta primate farm just outside New Orleans under the direction of Dr. Alton Ochsner, who has turned out as a real criminal. They raised monkeys, rhesus monkeys, and they killed them, and they took their kidneys and mashed them up. Excuse me. And they seeded these kidneys with swabs from the throats of the naval recruits that were infected with the mycoplasma. And lo and behold, the mycoplasma grew on those kidneys very, very readily. And they were able to harvest a tremendous amount of monkey kidney-grown mycoplasma. And then they were able to use that mycoplasma with certain research assignments. They handed out monkey kidney growing mycoplasma to all manner of researchers and asked them to do different things. When you put this with into chickens, does it sicken the chickens? They put it into mice? They put it into other primates? And the evidence is they also infected a great number of human beings in experiments, but never told the human beings that they were being infected with the mycoplasma. They did this at Huntsville Penitentiary in Texas, of course, the Baylor University or Baylor College of Medicine, up to their necks in the development of the AIDS pathogen, by the way. They took some of the mycoplasma and they injected it into prisoner volunteers and under this program, MK Ultra, MK Naomi, and MK Delta. Now, the thing is, they had to get at least the token agreement of Eisenhower, and he would not have gone along with the idea of population reduction to this extent, I'm sure. And there's no evidence he knew what they were doing. And in the report that was produced by Stansfield Turner when he became director of the CIA under Jimmy Carter, several places CIA witnesses say that we have no evidence that the president knew anything about this that was going on. But what they were doing was growing mycoplasma by the gallon, and they were distributing it and testing it, and they found that, hey, here is a great agent, because what it does, it destroys or limits the working power of the human immune system. So it's like you have a 6-foot fence around your yard, which keeps wolves out of the yard. You lower the fence down to 2 feet, and the wolves can jump over it. Well, the mycoplasma puts the immune system down. Then a number of other disease factors, which ordinarily do no harm at all, or very little harm, including pneumonia and Kaposi's sarcoma and so on, they became deadly diseases in people whose immune system was put down by the mycoplasma.
And of course, Kaposi is related. It's a viral infection, but if you don't have an immune system, why the virus takes over? Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, and they call them opportunistic diseases, and there's a whole list of them. As you know, some 28 or 29 different diseases.
Aviary tuberculosis, which is one of the pneumocystis.
Yes, it is,
pneumonia.
As a matter of fact.
And we'll be back in just a moment with Don here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Don Scott. Don, you picked the story up there.
Well, yes, they told Eisenhower a cover story when they established MKUltra. They told him they wanted to study brainwashing. And Eisenhower was very interested in this because, being a soldier, he was very embarrassed by the fact that several hundred American prisoners, when they got into the hands of the Chinese in the Korean War, they immediately began telling stories about being engaged in biological warfare activities. And interestingly enough, one of the people who was involved in biological warfare activities at the end of the Korean War, or towards the end of it, was E. Howard Hunt, who was later arrested in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, trying to ride out of town from behind Dealey Plaza on a freight train, and then was later arrested after being implicated in the Watergate break-in and the disposal of President Nixon. However, the American soldiers captured by the Chinese had bared their souls to the Chinese about biological warfare, and they were doing it. The Americans actually had biological weapons on inventory, and they actually employed them.
You're talking about, is that the Hanta virus there in Korea?
Oh, yes, and when the Hanta virus broke out, they took a young man from Boston Hospital and a couple of other places, Carlton Gazusek, and they threw him into an Army captain's uniform and sent him off to Korea to help control the Hanta virus outbreak in Korea. They had apparently let Hanta virus out into the air, blowing towards the enemy lines, and the wind changed direction and blew back onto the American lines, and thousands of American soldiers were exposed to this blowback of the virus. But Eisenhower approved the brainwashing undertaking of the MK Ultra, Naomi, and Delta. It doesn't seem that he asked, well, what does the MK stand for, Alan or Nelson? And if they had told him it stood for monkey kidneys, and he had asked a little further, chances are he would not have approved it. But he approved the founding of the MK programs, and they began growing the mycoplasma, and they established a mycoplasma laboratory out of Stanford University in California, and they put Dr. Leonard Hayflick in charge of that.
Hold that. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, Chris, you know, Don has been saying MK stands for a monkey kidney. Of course, some people think that MK stands for mind control. What would you say to them?
Well, if you spell control with a K, have something there. But you're reaching pretty far when you convert the word control from C-O-N-T-R-O-L to K.
All right, no question at all. Of course, the whole thing, the whole incredible story of what they were doing at that time is so incredible. But anyway, of course, your contention is that this is a monkey kidney. We know they were doing experiments with monkey kidneys, and they were producing new and terrible diseases. And, of course, one of them was a disease for which there'd be no immune response. So you picked the story up there.
Yes, and the MK Ultra was the umbrella research program. It had two subdivisions, MK Naomi, and there are various suggestions as to where the word Naomi comes from in that. We have a couple of explanations from various sources. But we're not too worried about it because it seemed to focus more upon the chemical aspects of what they were trying to do. The main program for the development of the AIDS cofactors was MK-Delta, monkey kidney delta. And when you look at the same period of time, the United States government had established a delta primate farm in the Mississippi Delta, and they gave a contract to Tulane University, and in Haslam's book, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, it's revealed there that the Dr. Alton Ochsner in the early 1950s was given two major clearances by the FBI to work for a secret U.S. agency. They don't specify the agency, but obviously it was CIA. And what was he to do? Well, at the same time, they established this Delta primate farm and start raising rhesus monkeys, and that was under the direction of Alton Ochsner, and he began supervising the execution of the monkeys and the salvaging of their kidneys and the growing of the mycoplasma. So you can reasonably tie Alton Ochsner into this whole thing under MK Delta, monkey kidney, Mississippi Delta, New Orleans, Covington, Louisiana, where they had the Delta primate farm, and where they also had an agricultural station where they were experimenting with another virus that they were using. Now, you see, our initial focus was on the mycoplasma, but then we learned that back in 1942, the Rockefellers had brought a Icelandic doctor, Bjorn Sigurdsson, to New Jersey to work in the Rockefeller Medical Institute and so on and so on. And Bjorn Sigurdsson was a specialist in an animal disease, even though he was a human medical doctor. He took a great interest in animal viruses and actually plant viruses too. And the Rockefellers brought Sigurdsson to the United States, and he took a couple of years of very specialized studies on plant, animal, and human viruses. And then they gave him several hundred thousand dollars and sent him back to Reykjavik, Iceland, where he established the pathogenic... the Experimental Pathogenic Institute. Now, experimental pathogens. Well, they're experimenting with various kinds of pathogens. And what would he tie that in with? Well, his specialty was the retrovirus. Now, a retrovirus, as you know, Dr. Stan, is one where the RNA, which is peeled off the DNA in order to manufacture certain enzymes and molecules the body needs, kind of backfires and takes over the DNA and directs the DNA to produce more of the RNA, which is the source of great damage in the cells that it infects. So here they have, up there in Iceland, Dr. Bjorn Sigurdsson. And when you see the literature, as you may have seen along the line, but I know you're very busy in a number of different ways, but we've been focusing on this for 12 years now, all the literature involving the retrovirus, the Vizna virus, the Meizhi virus, they called it, the Rita virus, all of these are related viruses, and including a disease of sheep called progressive pneumonia of sheep. Well, progressive pneumonia of sheep relates, of course, to the progressive pneumonia of the naval recruits. But they had Sigurdsson from Iceland working to adapt the retrovirus to humans. Now, up to that point, there was no evidence that any retrovirus had ever affected human beings. You can possibly find hints that there might have been a few instances, But certainly as a major point, no. Retroviruses were an animal, sheep disease, and monkey disease, but certainly not a human disease. And interestingly enough, the so-called HIV, human immune deficiency virus, HIV, is the first retrovirus to infect human beings. Well, here then you get two things. You get a mycoplasma, which puts down the immune system, and you get a retrovirus, which gets into the body of somebody whose immune system is down and starts reproducing itself within the body, so that the sick body is not only sick with the retrovirus and the mycoplasma, but it gets sicker because the retrovirus is running the DNA machinery, and every new cell that's produced has a bit of this retrovirus in it.
Because what this basically is a sheep virus, and of course, ordinarily these are retroviruses. And they don't infect human beings, but now they're able to grow them in human beings. What an amazing accomplishment. They've gotten this virus to jump the species barrier. And now, of course, you get a double whammy. You can actually get the patient ill because of mycoplasma, and then superimpose upon that this Bisna virus, which is, came to be known as HIV. And you've laid the foundation for a disease that, of course, for which there is no response, attacks the immune system and makes the individual susceptible to all sorts of other diseases that can, opportunistic diseases. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that sums it up well, Doctor. And Rockefeller and Allen Dulles, with the huge budgets of the CIA that was then given, went to work to bring the work of Bjorn Sigerson together with the work of Dr. Robert Huebner, and they had these cofactors then, which, of course, Robert Gallen tries to say, well, there's no such thing as cofactors, but we recently discovered a very early statement he made back in 1989, where he said that there were cofactors involved in AIDS. He seems to have forgotten he said that, but we've got the evidence that's in Discovery Magazine, an article that he wrote at that time. But anyway, Rockefeller and Dulles brought together the experimental machinery to bring the monkey virus to play, cofactored with the retrovirus of sheep in Iceland. And they did this between 1952 or 53. And they were coming along very, very nicely with it. They were well on their way to having AIDS very, very early on. And at the end of Eisenhower's 8 years, there was going to be an election. And, of course, everybody said Richard Nixon was going to be elected president in place of Eisenhower. And Richard Nixon had a friend called Roy Ash, who was a member of a group of young Harvard graduates, including Robert McNamara, who was called a whiz kid. And Roy Ash was an employee of Hughes Aircraft, and under the with the encouragement of Vice President Nixon, Roy Ash left Hughes and founded Litton Industries Limited, and a division of Litton Industries was Bionetics Limited. And Bionetics had a program of manufacturing vaccines that would be put into human beings to keep them healthy. So there was that area of coming together of big money and very clever industrial organizers, and the role of Vice President Nixon. And when Eisenhower retired and Nixon ran, he was going to get elected. Everybody was sure of that. But something happened on the way to the election. It was very funny. And that was the election of John F. Kennedy. Now, John F. Kennedy was opposed to this whole idea of population control. You can study the documents he wrote and the things he said about it, and he made points that, look, people only have big families when they have a poor environment and they want to ensure that they're going to have some descendants survive. If you have 9 out of 10 of your children dying off, then you're going to have 10 kids to make sure you at least have one. And all the evidence is that they never told Eisenhower, never told Kennedy anything about this MK Ultra program, other than that it was a brainwashing study. But the evidence is they told Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson, it turns out, was a very dishonest and duplicitous person. And Kennedy succeeded Eisenhower, the whole MK Ultra program went into kind of a hiatus for a short period of time until they got rid of Mr. Kennedy. And the NIH was involved in the murder of Mr. Kennedy. Now, this seems awfully startling. And you, doctor, you may want to reject it, or you may have listeners who want to reject it. But there's all kinds of evidence that not only was the CIA involved in getting rid of Mr. Kennedy, but the military was involved in doing it, and the National Institutes of Health were involved. Now, there's an interesting link there. We have in our files, sent to us by a gentleman who knows of our research, a photograph of a gentleman called Colonel Jose Rivera. Now, Colonel Jose Rivera was a researcher working for the United States Air Force at the time, and he's mentioned in the special virus cancer program he's not mentioned, but the place he was working is mentioned, Brooks Air Force Station. Dr. Jose Rivera said at one point prior to the assassination of President Kennedy, Jose Rivera was talking to somebody that he thought was on their side and thought was more informed than the person was, and the person was told Rivera that she was moving to a new job in New Orleans at Tulane University. And Jose Rivera said, well, here's a phone number. And he gave her a phone number, and this is all on file. This is all in the documentation of the Kennedy assassination. He gave her a phone number, and he says, call this number and ask for Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, this is before the assassination, of course, of President Kennedy. And he said, when you get Oswald, just for a joke, say to him, give him this message. He'll know what it means. Give him the message, kill the chief. And this lady, well, she thought Rivera was a bit of a nut, but she took the phone number, and she went down to New Orleans, and when she got settled there after a couple of weeks, she called the phone number given to her by Colonel Jose Rivera, who was at that point working for the National Institutes of Health. And she got this number, dialed it, somebody answered the number, and she said, is there a Lee Harvey Oswald there? And the voice said, no, you must have the wrong number, nobody here by that name. She said, oh, okay, thank you, and she hung up. And a couple weeks later, she was going through her papers on the desk, and she came upon this message again. She thought, well, maybe I dialed the wrong number. I'll try it once more before I throw the paper out. So she dialed the number again, and she said, is there a person there by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald? And the person who answered the phone said, yeah, just a minute. He called out, Lee, you're wanted on the phone. And this voice came on the phone and said, yeah. And she said, Mr. Oswald. And the guy answered, said, yes. And she said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm down from Washington, D.C., and I have a message for you from Jose Rivera. Kill the chief. And Oswald said, what are you talking about? And she said, he said, I don't know any Jose Rivera. And she said, well, he gave me your number. And Oswald said, well, how could he give you my number when I didn't know the number myself until just the other day when I moved in? And he moved in with the help of his cousin, Elizabeth Mireth, I think her name was, and it was after he moved in that he learned the phone number that had been given to this lady several weeks before by Dr. Jose Rivera. Now, what does this all mean? This all means that Lee Harvey Oswald was being run. He was being run by the CIA. They knew where he was going to be living. They knew what his phone number was. Jose Rivera knew, but Jose Rivera didn't realize that there were actually at least two Oswalds. One, the person who suffered gunshot wounds at the hands of Jack Ruby in Dallas, and another who was moving around the countryside in rather strange ways. Now, Dr. Jose Rivera, when we learned this information, and we published it in our journal, the Journal of Degenerative Diseases, a person from Louisiana wrote to us and said, gosh, I knew Jose Rivera, and I've got a picture of him, and I've got a certificate where he was given a certificate for medical research by the United States Air Force, and where he was working for the NIH. And he sent it to us, and we have it in our files. Now, this is an amazing linkage between the people who murdered President Kennedy and the people who were developing the cofactors that create AIDS.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Don, who is this woman? This wasn't the Mary of Mary Ferry and the...
No, Mary Sherman was working at Tulane University, and she was a great scholar. And she had a very strange friend. The friend was David Ferry, who was also a very, well, as I say, a very strange person. But that wasn't the same lady, and I haven't got her name right at my fingertip here. It's in our files. But the one who had the message to deliver, we've got that information. And when the JFK Records Act was passed by Congress a few years ago, the story was followed up, and they found in the files that, yes, indeed, after the murder of Mr. Kennedy, this lady had phoned the Secret Service, and she phoned the FBI, and both agencies had responded to her home in New Orleans, and she showed them the phone number, and she showed them the message, and they never turned that over to the Warren Commission, and they never turned the documentation over, and it didn't come to light until just a few years ago with the JFK Act, which, of course, followed Oliver Stone's movie JFK. But Mary Sherman was another link between the development of the AIDS cofactors and the murder of Mr. Kennedy. Because here is Dr. Mary Sherman of Tulane University School of Medicine, very, very accomplished scientist. She had a number of articles that are still valid articles published in medical journals. And she was working down in New Orleans, and she had a friend, David Ferry. Well, as I mentioned, David Ferry was a rather strange person. Some things, of course, he had no control over. For example, as a child, he had some kind of disease that caused him to lose all his body hair.
I think for our listeners, they should know that he was actually part of the investigation, of Garrison's investigation, the district attorney trying to tie the assassination of President Kennedy into some sort of a syndicate there in New Orleans. And just about the time that Ferry's going to be called to testify, he suddenly mysteriously dies.
Yes,
he was somehow related to taking care of these experimental monkeys that were being utilized, and they tie into Dr. Ochsner and, of course, the university there, and, of course, to this Mary Sherman. So you pick up the story from there. We'll be back in just a moment here with Don Scott. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. Now, if you would like to get the entire text of the this program, why, of course, it's available through Radio Liberty, we do talk through the breaks. Incidentally, we will be doing the next hour with Don Scott as we explore the rest of this incredible story. The HIV virus, which has killed over 500,000 people in America and 1.5 million infected, has killed tens of millions of people throughout the world, and it will be killing tens, if not hundreds of millions more, is a man-made virus because there are too many people in the world, and would the world be better off without so many people? The disease has a predilection for blacks. Now, much of this is covered in my material, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, in a book we carry called Emerging Viruses by Dr. Len Horowitz. Do you have is your book available now, Don?
Yes, it is. It's we just completed the latest book, which is AIDS, the Crime Beyond Belief, that is being emailed for printing and publishing by Trafford Publishing, and they will be notifying the media before many weeks. We expect 2 to 3 weeks now.
We'll be carrying Don's books because we think that Don does a lot of fascinating work. We also carry Garth Nicholson's book, Project Daylily. That's Project Daylily. So you need to get the information. You need to understand that they really are people out there who create new diseases to kill hundreds of millions of people. You need, of course, to get my talk on planned population reduction, that's planned population reduction, or population control, or my 14th set on population control. You need to understand what is really going on behind the scenes so that you can protect yourself. But understand the spiritual forces that energizes these people. And if you have not yet heard our talk on the forbidden secret, that's the forbidden secret, why that and so many other items are available at Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And as soon as Don's book is available, we'll certainly be carrying that. Because we think it's important that you have access to the extensive work that he's done. Don, do you want to get your website out here before we let our audience up there in the Great Northwest go? How can they get hold of you?
No, we're not on the web.
You're not on
the web. Actually, we are, but not as a research foundation. My son is on it independently, but if people wanted to get me, they could call me by long-distance telephone. Could I give my number that way?
You certainly can.
All right. It's 1, long-distance, of course, area code 705-533-3320. That's area code 705-533-3320.
All right, fine. And let me recommend Don's material. Anyway, we hope any of you, of course, if you want to get in touch with us, 1-800-544-8927 or radioliberty.com. And we'll be back. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to look into this further. Could this really be true? Would they really create new and terrible diseases like chronic fatigue, Lyme disease, AIDS, Gulf War illness? Are they really killing our boys over there with depleted uranium? Well, of course, let me suggest something, Beyond Treason by Joyce Rowley, with thousands of pages of government documents. Beyond Treason. And then, of course, Dr. Abe's talk on mercury autism and the global population control with a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of documentation. Our number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and the second hour of our interview with Don Scott. And so I'm just going to let Don go ahead and pick the story up there. Go ahead, Don.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Dulles had 8 years under President Eisenhower to do their work. They were to be succeeded by Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon lost the election to John F. Kennedy, who knew nothing about it. Evidently, none of the evidence shows contrary to this. He knew nothing about what was going on with MK Ultra and MK Delta. And he became a target for not only the NIH, but a number of other agencies like CIA, whom he was saying should be broken into 1,000 pieces and thrown to the wind. And there was a 3-year hiatus, 1,000 days of President Kennedy's administration, and then he was shot in Dallas by these strange assassins who had set up patsies such as Lee Harvey Oswald. Our evidence is very, very solid. Lee Harvey Oswald had absolutely nothing to do with the murder of President Kennedy. And also Lee Harvey Oswald's acquaintance, David Ferry, tied in as he was with the monkey viruses of Tulane University and Dr. Mary Sherman. But President Kennedy's administration was ended on November 22nd, 1963. He was succeeded by Lyndon Baines Johnson, and there we have made what we feel is a very important addition to the research that has been done by other great researchers in the past and continues to be made by others, and that is this. A lot of people believe quite reasonably and naturally that when on June 9th, 1969, when Dr. Donald MacArthur told the Congress that they could develop a new disease organism, one which does not naturally exist and which would be refractory to the human immune system, the congressman believed him and gave him the $10 million. But our evidence is that they had that disease cofactors long before that, and that it was let loose into the world with the knowledge of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Because Lyndon Baines Johnson said at a meeting that we've got the transcript of, he says that the world will soon know of a new, what was he called it, a new factor that we will have to all live with, that will drastically change our way of thinking and so on. And then the when you look at the budgeting and so on that was paid out, the money that went directly to the CIA was reduced, and the money that went into population control programs was radically increased by Lyndon Johnson, and he appointed a population control council with John D. Rockefeller on it and William Cohen on it and a number of other eugenicists on it, and they started using the Agency for International Development in Africa. They began vaccination programs then, and that's why when you look at the joint hearing of the Select Committee on Intelligence and Health and Scientific Research that was published in August the 3rd, 1977, when there was an investigation into MK Ultra, the chairman of that joint committee, Senator Iannou of Hawaii, said that the programs of biological weapons use and development and deployment and so on began in 1952 and went on to 1965. The programs were already well underway when MacArthur made that statement to the congressman. Now, why would he make it after they already had it?
Well, you hold that. I'll be back in just a minute here. All right, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, it's Don's contention that When Dr. MacArthur made that statement before Congress, and we do have the entire text of his testimony, saying that they could actually, with $10 million and 10 years, they could create this new disease for which there'd be no immune response, that Don believes that they already had the disease, and I've often believed that they had the disease already as well. Don then asked the question, why would he tell Congress, you give us the money, we can make it, when they'd done all of the experiments long before that? We know that because Don has accumulated copies of documents that were supposed to have been destroyed. They were the so-called special virus cancer programs that involved the majority of the major scientists in America. Now, most of them didn't know what they were working on. They were simply working on certain projects assigned to them for which they were well paid. But a few of them did understand what they were doing, and all of these very projects that were to be utilized to create these new types of deadly, horrible disease. So you pick up the story. Why do you believe that Dr. MacArthur made this statement when they already had the organism? They knew how to create it.
Well, our evidence, and we published this in our book, and we've got reams of evidence. Our evidence demonstrates that the CIA was working with the military and with certain parts of the health establishment on the AIDS cofactors long before 1969. And then, as I say, Johnson introduced this program in Africa, where they were sending over teams to vaccinate blacks way back in the early 1960s. So, and the things that Johnson wrote and said indicates that that was going on. But they weren't telling Congress this. And then when they got to 1969, they could safely tell Congress because they had just re-elected a new Republican Congress in 1968. And one of the first meetings following that was in early 1969, June 1969, where the Black Budget Committee met with Donald MacArthur, and he asked for the $10 million. Now, what he was doing, well, he was getting them on side, because the AIDS cofactors are what they call slow or lentiviral compounds, which don't present themselves for anywhere from 8 to 9 to 10 to 15 years. And MacArthur knew that the evidence would begin to show by 1980.
Don feels that that they had already begun to disseminate this, and they knew that it would take 10 to 15 years after they'd infected people with these retroviruses from the sheep before they began to manifest themselves. So, go ahead. And your contention then is that Dr. MacArthur told Congress about this new disease that they already had had for some time and had already been disseminating, because they knew it wouldn't be too long before it began to manifest itself. Is that it?
Yes, and in 1981, Dr. Michael Gottlieb wrote an article and published it on the strange new disease that was being manifest among the gay population of San Francisco. And now, if he had enough patients in 1980 to write and publish this article in 81, those patients must have been infected 5 or 6 or 7 years before. They weren't just infected the day before.
Well, do you think that they were infected as a result of the hepatitis B vaccine that they were given, this experimental vaccine that was
given specifically
to homosexuals?
They had the smallpox vaccine for Africa, and the poor black people had no choice. The Portuguese army and the Belgian army, the French army, and in certain instances the British army, insisted that blacks take the vaccine against smallpox. Initially it was being given out by the Americans under their Agency for International Development, and that went on in the early 1960s. And then they brought Dr. Henderson from Johns Hopkins to make a really big push of it in 1968 in Africa with the smallpox vaccine, but in 1976 there was a big push made in the United States to vaccinate gay men with a free hepatitis vaccine. Now, you know, suddenly getting generous with a free hepatitis vaccine is in itself very suspicious. But a number of gay men in 1976, they were offered a free vaccination against hepatitis. They lined up, a great number of them, and took it. And a significant percentage of those who took the vaccine, 5 years later, they were the ones with AIDS. And they were infected with a contaminated vaccine for hepatitis. The black people of Africa were contaminated with a smallpox vaccine. And both groups received the AIDS into their blood, the AIDS cofactors. Now, why bother contaminating a handful of gay men in the United States? Again, our research suggests to us very strongly that it was known that there was going to be this outbreak in Africa. A few years down the line, the black people of Africa are going to start dying at the rate of 1,000, 2,000 a day, and now it's up to 8,000 a day. And when that happens, all the fair-minded people, or a lot of fair-minded people in the free world, so-called, will want something done about it unless you turn them off. And the way to turn them off is to infect gay men and then call it the gay plague and then do as Ronald Reagan did when he was running for re-election in 1984. He said, not a cent of government money will be spent on AIDS research. The suggestion was that the gay men had brought this on themselves by their lifestyle, and they could live with it. Well, they soon realized that even though that was their rationale, they could not keep that point of for a period of time, but it lasted long enough so that the disease got well established in the black population of Africa, and people weren't saying do something about AIDS in Africa because they were associating AIDS with the gay plague. And the media advanced this idea because the words gay plague were coined by Time magazine, and so AIDS became for many years the gay plague, and people were turned off. And even today, there's an antipathy towards AIDS. For example, a number of people I've spoken to, they say, well, what are you working on? And I tell them my son and I are now writing our book on 12 years of research into AIDS. They say, AIDS? And they'll twist their face up and they'll say, ah. They still have an antipathy towards AIDS because they associate it with the lifestyle that they oppose. And this was intentional. That is why the U.S. put hepatitis vaccines available in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Give it to gay men. Turn people off of doing research. Allow Ronald Reagan to say that there will be not a cent of government money spent on AIDS research. And then when the AIDS is really sunk into place, and people have become somewhat more liberal in their attitudes towards same-sex marriages and so on, that slowly fades, but doesn't fade totally, and is still with us today.
Well, I think it's significant that about 75% of the homosexuals who took that vaccine in San Francisco came down with HIV, came down with AIDS.
Yes, absolutely. And see, they had a cover story for that, too, that we repeat in our book. They say that there was a Canadian airline steward by the name of Gaetan Dugas, and that Gaetan Dugas had some kind of sexual affair with a black woman, directly or indirectly, who had got AIDS from a monkey virus. She had been butchering a monkey, and the blood mixed with hers, and she became infected with a monkey virus, and then she had sex with Gaetan or somehow or other along the line. And then Gaitan suddenly turned homosexual, and using his pass, which he had with Air Canada, he was a historic figure. He's known. He's on the records of Gay Canada, Air Canada, as an employee and so on. He is supposed to have traveled throughout the United States having homosexual affairs in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. But the thing is, he lived and worked in Canada for many years, and he flew between Toronto and Vancouver, and there was no such outbreaks there. Finger pointing at Gaétan Dugas is very suspicious, because at one point a Centers for Disease Control individual has said, well, we monitored Gaétan Dugas from the time he entered the United States. Oh? How do you monitor airline stewards that are flying in and out of the United States every day and for many months on end? It just isn't done. It's something that's a story, a cover that's invented later to account for the fact that suddenly in those three cities, these gay men who had developed AIDS after getting a hepatitis vaccine, something had to explain how they all got it, and so they blamed it on Gaétan Dugas. And we point that out, but it's only one of the many, many, many stories that just don't hold water when you look at them and you look at the scientific evidence.
There's a wonderful book written by a homosexual in the band played on by Randy Schilt, who carries all of these official party line stories, but the book is still important from a historical point of view. But of course, you're absolutely right. Gaétan Dugas was supposedly the patient zero the CDC study, and I remember talking to Jim Curran at the CDC headquarters and back there in Atlanta, Georgia, about Gaétan Dugas. And I think he may have suspected that this whole thing has a created disease, a created epidemic. I don't know whether he did or not, but I do know that shortly after I talked to him, why he quit his job at the CDC and went to work for Emory University. But go ahead.
Yes, well, one study suggested that Gaétan Dugas would have had to have had 2,500 sexual partners in a two-year period. So that's over a period of about 700 days. He has 2,500 sexual partners. It's just nonsense, pure nonsense. He'd have to be engaged in sexual activities 24 hours a day and not be doing any work, let alone flying around the United States spreading this disease. So that's the kind of hocus-pocus you get from the media assets that try to interpret the outbreak of AIDS and chronic fatigue as something totally different from what they are.
Did you, of course, get into the fact that this disease has a predilection for blacks?
Oh, yes. Well, our research turned up something very, very important. We learned that in 1957, Dr. Shepherd had been given a contract to do some research, and we include this in our reports, in our book. And Dr. Shepherd had taken 100 healthy black college students and 100 healthy white college students, and he tested both of them for mycoplasma. The 100 healthy black students, normally healthy black students, no sign of disease, 33% of them were infected with Mycoplasma fermentans, but it was doing them no harm at all. And the 100 white college students, only 2% of them were infected with the mycoplasma. We report the we give the whole report in the book, or a summary of it, and the figures. Now, what does this mean? This means that AIDS, as a result of cofactors, mycoplasma on the one hand, and a retrovirus or something else like Kaposi sarcoma or pneumonia and so on the other, as a cofactor, the black people, by natural possession, genetically determined possibly, have...
Hold that thought right there. Well, I was just asking Don about the predilection of the HIV infection, of this mycoplasma AIDS infection for blacks. And certainly it is much more common in blacks in the United States. It's much more common in blacks generally in Africa today, where in countries like Botswana, the pregnant women, 46% are HIV infected, and it's all being followed by your Commerce Department with your tax money. What is the Commerce Department and the Census Department of the United States doing in Botswana? Well, we're checking to see what a good job we're doing. And we've done a very, very, well, either a very, very poor public health job or a very effective genocidal job in Botswana and so many other countries in Africa, where thousands of people die every day. So, Don, what did you find out about the predilection of blacks for this AIDS syndrome?
Well, as I mentioned, the Dr. Shepherd's statistics demonstrated very, very solidly that 2 out of 100 white college students carried the mycoplasma naturally and weren't presenting with any disease, and 33 blacks out of 100 were carrying it. Now, if they both get exposed, the 100 blacks and the 100 whites both get exposed to the other cofactors, 33 blacks will become ill because they will have both cofactors, but only 2 out of the 100 whites will get ill. And that gives a percentage of black people susceptible to AIDS as compared to whites. And it's obviously something that wasn't accidental. It was discovered that the blacks carried this mycoplasma naturally. Now, there's nothing wrong with carrying the mycoplasma because it's determined by years of living conditions and food and exposure to various disease agents and so on, and they've adapted to it. Their immune systems are very solid, and they are not affected by the presence of mycoplasma. But when it is acting as a cofactor with some other factors, such as Bjorn Sigurdsson's Vizsna virus or scrapie, then they will become ill with the AIDS, and 33 out of 100 will, and only 2 out of 100 whites will. And we put that into our book as well, along with other significant facts, which, and let me emphasize, at least 90% of the documentation we use are government documents or are peer-reviewed articles from journals such as the Journal of American Medical Association or the New England Journal of Medicine or Lancet or Science Magazine. They're not the articles that other interested people have written from a more amateur position, but they are written by scientists who have studied the data. And we have studied their data, and we have done something that they haven't done. We've related it to what was going on politically and financially in the world at the same time, and who were the people that were in charge of all this. And that's, of course, where Nelson Rockefeller and Alan Dulles and Lyndon Johnson and others come in. And we point out that when Nixon came to power, all the evidence is that the AIDS epidemics were well planted, but there was still bodies
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Don is pointing out that by the time Richard Nixon became president in 1968, why, of course, the HIV, this AIDS complex, which is a complex, it is not simply HIV, it is a complex of HIV and mycoplasma. It was well planted. And you must understand that one of the major thrusts of America's policy was population control. If you have not yet read the National Security Study Memorandum 200, you can pull it down off the Internet. It is available for Radio Liberty, nicely bound. National Security Study Memorandum came out in 1974. A top secret document, of course, over the signature of Henry Kissinger, talking about how population control throughout the world was a major thrust of American policy, and it still is. In fact, the Republicans in the last few years have been giving more money to worldwide population control than the Democrats did. And, of course, what it really means is killing off large segments of the world's population. When you understand that, you begin to understand what is really going on. How do you kill people? War, disease, epidemics, starvation, vaccinations, very efficient means of introducing new diseases, outlawing effective treatments for disease, for malaria prevention like DDT, and we could go down the line encouraging cancer. Cancer used to be 3 in 100, now it's 50 in 100, as in all sorts of insecticides and pesticides and genetically altered foods and mercury and in our shots and fluoride in our water and aspartame in our food supply. But go ahead, Don. I mean, there is a major thrust towards population control, and the average individual finds it so difficult to believe because nobody can be that totally evil, crass, and depraved. Unfortunately, they are people who are evil, crass, and depraved. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, well, the thing is, Dr. Stan, that we look at them as being evil, and I think most objective, rational people look at them as objective, but in all probability, they probably think of themselves as bearing a very heavy burden of knowing a lot more than we do, and it's this noblesse oblige sort of thing. They do these things for the good, the greater good of mankind, and kill off 8,000 blacks a day. But to go back to our historic tracing of the evolution of AIDS, the cofactors, and the collateral damage it does, because now that the mycoplasma is spread much more widely through the population generally than it was a few years ago, a lot of diseases such as diabetes type 1 and Wegener's disease and Kabuchi's disease and multiple sclerosis are increased significantly in number. And this is just what they would refer to as collateral damage. The main damage is killing off black people with AIDS, and they can't kill off white people in the same numbers without a revolution on their hands, so they don't kill them, they disable them, and they disable the female part of the population rather than the male. And we point out in our book how why it is that women are more susceptible to chronic fatigue syndrome than our men. And the reason is very, very logical. We present the scientific reality that the mycoplasma only presents as a disease factor reducing the immune system if it achieves a certain level of concentration in the blood. And a woman has 1 liter less blood, pound for pound, than a man has. For example, if you have a 150-pound man and a 150-pound woman, the man will have about 5 liters of blood, the woman will have 4. She will therefore become concentrated with the disease factor much more rapidly than man will. And also, since the hemoglobin is involved, and the mycoplasma has a great ability to destroy hemoglobin, as we present, a woman's blood contains about 20% less hemoglobin than male blood contains. So that's why women have more chronic fatigue syndrome than men. It has nothing to do with the story that the babbling that came out of Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes for Health, that this was a disease of the brain, imagined disease, because they couldn't stand the pressures of modern life, that kind of baloney.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Don Scott, who's it's getting a little late up there where Don is, but he's holding up well. He's doing a great job. And so we'll be right back here with Don as we begin exploring the background of this terrible plague that has killed tens of millions throughout the world unnecessarily today. Well, Don, why don't you go ahead and pick the story up there?
All right. Well, we left off with the research that was done in the early 1950s and into the 60s, and the brief hiatus with President Kennedy's administration, and then the murder of Mr. Kennedy, and within months, Lyndon Johnson had the whole program back on track, but he brought it out of the CIA cellar, and in that year, 1964, when he succeeded for one full year of Mr. Kennedy's term and then was reelected for another 4 years in his own right, it was in 1964 that Johnson introduced the special virus. But it wasn't a cancer program that he introduced at that time. As he called it, the special virus leukemia lymphoma program. And then they pretty quickly dropped that because the leukemia and lymphoma, they realized, is very closely tied in with the mycoplasma. And as you know, Dr. Luc Montagnier, when he discovered something strange in the blood of people with AIDS, he called it a lymphadenopathy-associated virus. In other words, a disease that affected the lymph glands and lymphoma. But around that period of time, or a few years afterwards, Dr. Elaine de Freitas at Wistar Institute was doing some research on the blood of chronic fatigue patients, and she began to find particles of the retrovirus in the blood of chronic fatigue people. And when she publicized this, she immediately became the target of quite a bit of scientific challenge, often poorly founded and rather rude. But the very interesting story that we recount in our book, we were doing our research, and we had a phone call a few years ago, and this caller identified herself as Dr. Elaine de Freitas, and she wanted to buy a copy of our book, The Extremely Unfortunate Skull Valley Incident. And we said, well, my goodness, we're honored to have a call from you, Dr. de Freitas. We won't charge you for the book. We'll send you a complimentary copy, which we did. A few weeks later, we got a call from Dr. de Freitas, and she said, my goodness, if I had read your book at that time, which, of course, she couldn't have done, I would have done things a lot differently. And I said, oh, why is that? Well, she said, when I first published my results of my research and found the retrovirus in the blood of chronic fatigue patients, I had a phone call from Dr. Brian Mahi of the Centers of Disease Control. And Dr. Mahi said, Elaine, you must be wrong. There's no way that you can find a retrovirus.
Hold that thought there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Don is talking about this woman, Elaine de Freitas, Dr. Elaine de Freitas, who is studying chronic fatigue. Now, remember that to many people, they feel that chronic fatigue is HIV-negative AIDS, because these people have everything except the HIV, but of course, they get all sorts of infections. Their immune system is destroyed. So Dr. Elaine de Freitas had found remnants, evidence of the retrovirus in the patients with chronic fatigue. Now you find this, of course, in AIDS, but she is finding it in chronic fatigue, and she gets a call from somebody from the CDC who says, oh, you must be mistaken. There is no retrovirus involved with chronic fatigue. So pick the story up.
Yes, well, she said to Dr. Mahi, well, I'm finding these particles. There's not a great deal of it, but obviously there's something foreign in the blood that's affecting the immune system. And Dr. Mahi said to her, well, look, Elaine, if I send you over the blood of 30 or so patients that we are working with at the Centers for Disease Control who have chronic fatigue syndrome, will you test that blood for the particles, the retrovirus? She said, yes. And then he said, now, if we send somebody along to monitor what you're doing, to determine what your protocols are and see if we're doing everything right, would that be all right? And she said, oh, yes, that'd be fine. So within a few weeks or whatever, this blood arrived, and a gentleman arrived from Dr. Mahi's office, and she went through this protocol for several weeks, doing this to the blood, doing that to the blood, and doing other things to it. and then examining it for the retroviral particles, and none of them had the retroviral particles. And she felt very bad about that, but she couldn't explain it, and she confessed to Mahi that, no, there was none turned up in that blood you sent me. Then she said to us, you know, after reading your book, I am of the view that he could even have sent me goat's blood. And she said, that's why we found no evidence, because I realized after, she said, that when I did my testing, I had some controls who were perfectly healthy, didn't have chronic fatigue, but they contributed their blood for the test. And even though they were perfectly healthy, there was a small percentage of them had also the retroviral particle, but it wasn't doing them any harm. And she said that wasn't even present in this blood that Mahi sent me. So I think he sent me some kind of blood that would never test positive for the retrovirus. And I said, my gosh, that's hard to understand. And then I, out of the blue, I was inspired to ask her a question. I said, by the way, Dr. DeFreitas, in your work with the Centers for Disease Control, did you ever run across a doctor by the name of Jose Rivera? Now, bear in mind, Jose Rivera was the fellow who wanted Lee Harvey Oswald to be phoned and given a weird message. And she said, oh, yes, my goodness. She said, as a matter of fact, it was Jose Rivera that Mahi sent over to monitor my work. And I said, well, my goodness.
It's a small world, isn't it?
Well, yes, and she said, well, why do you ask? And I said, I hate to tell you. And she said, no, why do you ask? I said, Jose Rivera, before November 22, 1963, knew Lee Harvey Oswald and had given a person a message to Lee Harvey Oswald. And I said, this is in the figures now, or the reports now published under the JFK Records Act. And she said, oh, my goodness, what's that supposed to mean? And I said, well, we have our views, but all we do now is just point out to you that Dr. Jose Rivera, who was sent over to you by Dr. Brian Mahi, had this involvement. And she said, oh, my goodness. And we finished our conversation at that point. And I've never heard from her since. And I don't know how she's doing. I know that her health has gone downhill terribly, I understand. And but we report the details in our book, and we give the relevant supporting evidence and so on. And we have other instances that we publish that now make a great deal of sense against what our major thesis is. Our major thesis is that AIDS and chronic fatigue are both diseases which are influenced by a disease organism called the mycoplasma. It was developed over the 1950s, early 1950s. It had originally been discovered way back in 1898 by Drs. Nocard and Roux in the Pasteur Institute in France. But because it was so small and lacked a cell wall, the average doctor couldn't find it anyway. And so it faded from sight until Dr. Huebner found it in the recruits. And he published his reports wherein he said, look, here is a disease agent which will attack the membrane of cells and cause them to degenerate.
And now, do you think that this has been actually genetically modified or modified in laboratories to make it more pathogenic?
Yes, they had to do a number of things to it. They first of all, they had to get a sufficient quantity of it, because it turns out that an important factor is concentration. The reason that the naval recruits were getting it as regularly as there were this pleural pneumonia, the reason they were getting it, and the average American male the same age and same health status wasn't, was because the average American male, after he finished his work, when he may have been in contact with somebody who was a carrier of a mycoplasma, He went home to his own home where there was nobody who was a carrier, and the windows opened in his bedroom and all the rest of it, whereas the recruits, they slept together, they ate together, they trained together. In other words, they were constantly being re-exposed to the mycoplasma. That's why they presented with the mycoplasmal illness rather than the average citizen presenting with it. And this is now borne out by the fact that, for example, among the major employee groups that present with the diseases related to chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia are airline crews. Now, these are crews who are regularly in airplanes where the air is recirculated, recirculated, recirculated. The passengers, you know, they get on, but they get off after 2 or 3 hours. The crew get off, but they get back on another plane very shortly. So the concentration in the blood of the airline crews builds up, builds up, builds up, and then they begin to present with a very high level of chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and other related diseases.
Now, is there actually a higher incidence of chronic fatigue among airline stewardesses and airline pilots than the general population, Don?
Absolutely. They are the highest group. Next to them are teachers, and next to teachers are medical staff in hospitals. They are people who, unlike the average citizen, change their environment when they from day to day. They're people who are exposed day after day to a variety of mycoplasmal infections, and the concentration builds up and ultimately reaches that point of concentration where it begins to affect their immune system, and then they begin to present with HIV minus AIDS, which is chronic fatigue.
Yep.
And it has nothing to do with the sexuality. We have to emphasize that.
I wondered, Don, you were mentioning that this one doctor had found some fragments of a retrovirus there. Now, mycoplasma isn't a retrovirus, so are you suggesting that there's a mycoplasma and some retrovirus in this, or what was...
Yes, there seems to be a relationship there, and we have been puzzling over that and we even refer to Dr. Carlton Gashusek, who speculates that even though the Vizsla virus is a disease of sheep and the mycoplasma is a disease of other animals, mostly cattle, and to an extent human beings, that they are all variants of the same basic viral origin. And this becomes something to kind of puzzle over because, as you know, the mycoplasma is a particle of the DNA or RNA of a bacterium, but it is one which lacks a cell wall, whereas a virus is the same particle of the nucleic acid of a bacterium, but it has a self-constructed protein protective coat. It's almost as if mycoplasma has not had time to prepare itself for being shed, whereas the virus, over millions of years of evolution, has been able to develop survival techniques. When it is threatened, then particles of the nucleic acid build themselves a protective protein coat, which keeps them safe until they find a host that will let them in, and when they get in, well, fine, then they can shed their protein coat and do their job with the toxic effects that they present with. The mycoplasma doesn't have that protective protein coat, but it seems that they are almost, and I'm very hesitant about this because research is so vague on it, the mycoplasma is almost a virus that doesn't have the protective coat. And because of that lack of protective coat, it didn't normally naturally survive all that well. But given the kind of tender, loving care that the researchers gave it after Dr. Huebner discovered it in his naval recruits, and growing it on monkey kidneys where it got all the nutrients it wanted, they were able to get enough active, dynamic mycoplasma to get it circulating pretty broadly through the world, and including North America, of course, where I don't know the percentages to be quite accurate, but there is a significant number of people in the United States, Canada, Australia, Britain, and so on, that present with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia now that years ago didn't seem to be presenting with it.
Not only that, but of course we also see it in the Gulf War syndrome, of course we see it in AIDS. What is this mycoplasma that the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology has a patent on? Where does that fit in?
Well, yes, now we wondered why the United States government would go to the trouble of putting a patent on Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus species with Dr. Shai-Ching Lo, who is director of the military research and so on. And we think they probably did it so that they would have a better control of people who were doing any research or work with the mycoplasma. It's just one more level of control to control the research and experimentation that's to be done. As you know, most of the research today, especially in the United States, and mainly in the United States, is dominated by money, and most of the money is dominated by the NIH, and they don't give it out to people who want to really do honest, independent research. They give it out to people who they want to do an area of research, a particular area that would be of concern to them. And that is one level of control, money. The other level of control is a patent on the mycoplasma by Dr. Shai-Ching Lo. And you would be interested, Dr. Stan, to know that while we're working on our book, we're also working on the next issue of our Journal of Degenerative Diseases, which is a special issue devoted to cancers. And we have discovered a number of pieces of information that came out of the secret work that was being done under the Special Virus Cancer Program and so on, but was also being done in the United States under what they call the White Coat Program, where they had a number of young men who did not want to serve in Vietnam, who volunteered to be guinea pigs for testing various biological agents. And we have found one of the types of research they were doing, they were being infected with sandfly bites. And they found that if they were infected with sandfly bites, that their bodies responded rather strangely. Their bodies responded by producing a tremendous additional flow of growth hormone. Now, why would that be? Why would the body start generating growth hormone because it's subjected to sandfly biting? And then we realized that, well, look, the growth factor is a part of cancer. If the cell gets the message to reproduce, it will do that, all other things being equal, but if it's a perfectly healthy cell, it will turn away that growth factor. But if it's a cell that's damaged due to smoking, for example, in the lungs, or due to breast cancers that develop because of hormonal differences, because a woman with the breast cancer has been on hormone-altering birth control pills for a number of years, then the cells will let that extra growth factor in, and that will stimulate cancerous growth, reproduction of the cells without limit. And that is the next issue of our journal. That's only part of it. But you see, that program where they infected these young conscientious objectors with sandfly toxin, and they found that that then caused the reproduction of growth hormone to an excessive amount. That is a factor in causing cancers. And Dr. Shai-Ching Lo, who patented the chronic, patented the mycoplasma, he has a very good article along with a number of other researchers about the links between mycoplasma and the cancer. And we put that into the book as well as into the next issue of the journal.
Well, I'm really looking forward to getting the book, and I want our listeners to know that as soon as the book is available, why we'll be offering it or making it available to Radio Liberty. Don has done some of the most fascinating research and study, and of course we're going to have to get him back again because I think that we've just begun to scratch the surface. Do you think we could do another 2 hours sometime on this subject?
Well, I'm happy to share the information, and I want to say, Dr. Stan, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with your listeners and you about it, and I want to suggest to them, too, something very important. My son and I do this research because we're concerned. We get no pay for it. We do it because of our conviction that it needs to be done.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment, Don. Go right ahead.
Well, we feel that as honestly as we can make it, that is our research. We study the diseases that we're looking at not only from a medical, scientific, chemical, biological, microbiological perspective and so on, but we study it from a political power structure. We look, for example, at the fact that with the billions and billions and billions of dollars going into cancer research and cancer treatment, the number of people getting cancers basically over the last 35 or 40 years has gone up every year. There's been a certain leveling off of certain cancers, but a certain increase in other cancers. Where is all their research money going? Why don't they discover things that we have discovered? For example, why did we have to look and look and look to suddenly come to the realization why more women had chronic fatigue than men had? And we realized when we studied blood in the human body and noted the difference between the blood supply of women and of men and the need of a certain level of concentration being reached in that blood of the mycoplasma, that's why women present sooner than men. And yet that was not reported or apparently not discovered by NIH and all their high-paid researchers, or it was discovered and purposely kept quiet, and media assets were purposely given the story, well, this is an imaginary disease which is invented by neurotic women who want an excuse for their failures in the world. That is the kind of baloney that came out of NIH and Centers for Disease Control for many years about chronic fatigue, and of course the story about AIDS. A black woman gets bit by a green monkey and has an affair with an Air Canada steward, and he circulates around the world carrying the disease with him. All baloney.
Don, I want you to get your telephone number out because we're just about out of time. Let's get your telephone number out one more time.
1-705-523-3320.
One more time.
1-705-523-3320.
We're out of time, Don, but God bless you. Thanks so very much for being
with us. Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate chatting with you.
And I'm looking forward to the next issue of the journal and the book. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. I hope you've enjoyed the interviews with Don Scott. He does publish a journal, and it's excellent. The journal goes into the background of all of the research. We do carry his book on the Skull Valley Incident. That's the book on the Skull Valley Incident. We do carry Dr. Garth Nicholson's excellent book, Project Daylily. Project Daylily goes into the background of the threats on his life, the attempts to kill both he and his wife, because, of course, he had uncovered much of what what Don Scott has been talking about. If you've not yet read my book, AIDS, the unnecessary epidemic, and let me recommend it. The book Emerging Viruses by Len Horowitz is still a classic. And, of course, you can go up to my website and read some of our articles on genetic engineering, on planned population reduction, on how they've created new and terrible and horrible diseases. And a good trick is to go to my, just to Google in Radio Liberty and population control, or Radio Liberty and vaccines, and actually, or even if we talk about a name, and you know it's in the article, just type in Google in Radio Liberty and the name, and you'll go right to the newsletter. And actually, I use that all the time because I can't remember what date I wrote something in the year 2001. But fortunately, Google can. So we do hope that you'll use that trick and technique. Now, let me suggest some of the DVDs we have. My talk on planned population reduction, our four-tape set on population control, or our video on a population control, Dr. David Ayoub's excellent DVD and or video, the Mercury, Autism, and the Global Population Agenda. Why is it that the people who are so intent upon population control want to vaccinate little black children all throughout the world to try to save their lives? How can you have it both ways? Either in favor of population control and mass killing, or you're in favor of vaccination and saving the lives, unless, well, you'll certainly want to see the DVD. And remember, that comes along with a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of documentation. Joyce Riley's excellent DVD, Beyond Treason, goes into depleted uranium, and you get a free CD-ROM with thousands of pages of government documentation. We carry, of course, the CD-ROM with thousands of pages of declassified articles on mind control, CIA, MK, Ultra Mind Control. They're all available from Radio Liberty. And, of course, we do hope that many of you will go to our website and look on the videos online, and or perhaps you would like more information on obtaining anything we talk about. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free newsletter, a free catalog of one sort or another, and we do have a number of free catalogs for various issues, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. Now, how do you really explain what we've been talking about this last 2 hours? Well, there's organized evil in the world. That's what it's all about. There are people who look at the world differently than you and I, who have no respect for human life. My talk, The Forbidden Secret. My talk, Brotherhood of Darkness. The DVDs by Chris Pinto, entitled The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. Riddles in Stone, the video and or DVD that we offer by Chris Pinto, The Atlantis Connection, the DVD or video by Constance Cumby, The Emergence. All of this information is available through Radio Liberty and no place else. If you're interested in knowing more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. As I say, if you'd like a free newsletter, would be glad to send you one. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. If you're going to the conspiracy conference tomorrow, we'll see you there. If not, till Monday, may the Lord be with you.